Welcome to This Is Money podcast. I'm Georgie Frost, and joining me and editor Simon Lambert today is deputy editor Helen Crane. And coming up, the great This Is Money debate. Are we in line for another financial annus horribilis in 2023? Or are things on the up? And this will in fact be an annus mirabilis. Simon and Helen fight their corners. I'm not sure what the Latin is for not so good, not so bad, pretty average, annus tolerabilis maybe? Anyway, also today, a burst of properties listed for sale on Boxing Day, but is this a last hurrah before the market goes quiet? Until that is, all those couples who are going to split on Monday, aka Divorce Day, put their homes up for sale. But is the cost of living forcing miserable couples to stick together? Plus pensions in 2023, what savers and retirees need to know, and NS&I has upped its prize rate. Is now a good time to get some premium bonds? Don't forget to stay up to date with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app.
Market updates and conversations around the financial world don't have to be boring. The Digest and Invest podcast by eToro is a great way to tune into what's happening in a fun and easily digestible format. Discover the Digest and Invest podcast at etoro.com/academy/podcasts.
But first, a happy new year. Loyal listeners, a happy new year, Simon and Helen, and a happy new year to Simon, not this Simon, another Simon, loyal listener to This Is Money and pilot of the Christmas Day flight from Gatwick to Cyprus. I just have to give a special honorary mention here, as I was on this flight, by the way, front seat. Apparently that's first class. So Simon told me. Simon, the pilot, came out and said, "I'm a big fan of your podcast." Wow, you have no idea how the people in the seats around me looked at me like a celebrity after that. So Simon, for that moment on Christmas Day and making us feel very, very special, thank you. I wasn't quite sure what he was talking about or whether he was talking to me. I mean, I remember the days when podcasts were like 16-year-olds in their pants in their bedroom stuff. But now we're celebrities, Simon and Helen.
I'm impressed, because I was right. Going to ask you, Georgie, how on earth did you know that the pilot of your flight listened to the podcast? Because I've never, ever got on a flight before and the pilot has announced that, you know, we're taking off and we're flying here. And this is a list of my favourite podcasts.
That would have been amazing if it had gone, "Hello, welcome to the Wizz Air flight to Larnaca on Christmas Day. We have a special celebrity on board. This Is Money podcast host Georgie Frost." Sadly, Simon and Helen are not with us, but we wish you a happy flight. And here's one of their previous episodes. Wouldn't that have been marvellous? Anyway, I gas on. But thank you very much. That made me blush very hard. So let's move on. Right. New year, same old, same old. According to economists, we're gearing up for one of the worst recessions and weakest recoveries in the G7 in the coming year. And it's households that are paying the price for the government's policy failings, so they say. Inflation may fall back a bit, but interest rates and energy bills will continue to climb in 2023, and the taxman will take a larger cut of our take-home pay. So are we set for another year of doom and gloom? Or maybe not. Maybe things aren't as bad as they seem. Simon, Helen, so are we to be pessimistic or cautiously optimistic about this year? Let us have a New Year discussion in the form of a sixth form school junior debating society manner. Simon, you are going to be taking, if that's all right, the side of the optimists. I have just told you this about 30 seconds before going to air, so thank you very much for your being willing and taking part in this. And Helen, I'm afraid it's the bad news for you. No particular reason. I mean, Simon has been cautiously optimistic in the past, which is why I thought Simon would take that position. But you go first, Helen, shall we? It's always better to get the bad news out of the way. So is it going to be just another really rubbish year for our finances? And by the way, this is not what you really necessarily think. This is you positioning all the negative rubbish, and that we'll get to the real stuff in the end of what we actually think. But, you know, you're taking the side of the pessimists.
Yeah, so unfortunately, I think I have the slightly easier job of the two here. Obviously, inflation is still incredibly high. So the latest figures, 10.7% in November. So it's not quite as high as it has been. A couple of months ago, it was over 11%, but it's still incredibly high. And I think the key thing for this year is it's going to take quite some time for inflation to fall back to what we know is normal levels. So the Bank of England's target for inflation is 2%. It's going to take a long time for things to get back down to that level. The Bank of England itself has said it expects inflation to continue to fall gradually over the first quarter of the year and return to 2% in the medium term. We don't know quite what that means, but probably not for the bulk of 2023 at least. The bank has also said there are considerable uncertainties around the outlook. So still really uncertain, high inflation. Obviously, one of the key things for households is going to be energy bills. They're still very high. They're obviously capped at the moment by this government price guarantee, but that still means that for the average household, that's £2,500 a year. From April, the government is increasing that cap to £3,000 a year. And this week, we've had some news from Cornwall Insight, who are the energy analysts. And they've said that from July, bills are going to fall below the government's energy price guarantee. So they think that they're going to settle at around £2,800 for the second half of the year. That might sound good, but if you think back to a couple of years ago, so October 2020, the price cap was £1,162 a year. So it's still an incredible rise compared to what people are used to paying. In other areas as well, food price inflation is still rampant. So last month, the latest figures show 13.3% inflation in the price of food in December. So still, unfortunately, a really, really tough year for households. And, you know, that has knock-on effects to other things as well. So the best mortgage rates are still well above 4%. Doesn't look like a good outlook for house prices necessarily. I'm afraid it doesn't look like it's going to be a great year for our finances.
Thank you very much, Helen Crane. You can now sit down while Simon Lambert will stand up and give the argument for the optimists for 2023. Simon Lambert.
Well, Helen stole my thunder there with all this talk of inflation. The first bit of good news I was going to give you is that Rishi Sunak is going to halve inflation this year. A man who, thanks to his previous position as Chancellor and working at a hedge fund, has a reasonably sound grasp of maths and knows that halving inflation isn't actually that hard if inflation is really high. And actually, it still means prices will be going up by 5% a year. But that is good news, because it's much better news than prices going up by 10% a year after they went up by 10% a year, and so on and so on. The compounding effect of 10%, 10%, 10% is much greater than 10%, 5%, and then hopefully back down to 2%. I think that actually perhaps inflation could fall away quicker than people think. This is possibly a product of some slightly bad news in a slowdown in the global economy. But that slowdown in the global economy is already happening. It's already happened. There are signs that we're already in recession. There are, you know, looking at everything from the construction sector to people spending. And whilst that would not usually be considered to be good news, the good news is that it's already here. And so we're worrying about something that's going to happen in the future that is already happening. And the effect of this is that it's going to bring down inflation. It's probably going to slow interest rate rises, which is going to be good news for borrowers. Mortgage rates are coming down even as the Bank of England base rate is going up. So we're seeing a bit more normality restored there. But I also think that the economy is likely to prove to be more resilient than people think. This is because although there are quite a lot of people who are suffering quite badly at the moment in this country, and I very much feel very sorry for them, people for whom there is a genuine cost of living crisis, people choosing between heating and eating, struggling to pay their bills. There is also a scenario where there are plenty of people in this country who still have plenty of money and lots of savings. And they have the ability to see their way through. And I also think that there is an appetite still to spend from those people. So I think we're going to see a weird recession, because you've got a chunk of people, older people, generally wealthier people, people who own properties without mortgages and so on. You've then got the people, the baby boomer generation, that is the wealthiest generation ever to have lived, and is now retiring and enjoying spending their money, enjoying going out to dinner, enjoying going on holiday, enjoying going to the shops. And they're coming off the back of not being able to do stuff for a couple of years. If you go back 1 year, even though we didn't have COVID restrictions, people were still very, very worried about Omicron and so on. go back a year before, we had that miserable winter lockdown and so on. So that people actually want to get out, they want to do things. If you go out and you look at, you know, restaurants, pubs, you know, places on the high street, they're still relatively busy, despite the relentless bad news that we keep getting. And I think that that will, to an extent, see us through. And then also, if you look at the younger generation, who tend to have much less wealth, much less savings, there are still a lot of people, not everybody, because not everybody managed to do this. Some of us, you know, some people's household incomes dropped catastrophically during COVID, and they saw no real benefit from the whole working from home and saving thing. But there are lots of people who did see a benefit there, and they've still got a lot of that lockdown savings built up. This has been commented on by various economists, you know, by the Bank of England previously. And I think that that will help see people through. And whilst it feels weird to be saying that we could be optimistic at a point when everybody's paying an absolute bomb on their bills, food prices are going up, there's miserable warnings of recession left, right and centre, the point where it feels like things stop going up and people start to see their bills fall a bit and everything like that will give people a little fillip of confidence and a little bit of a boost. And I don't think that the looming recession will be as bad or as painful as it has been painted in some corners.
I think I chose well there with divvying that up. Simon, you genuinely seem to believe the optimist position.
Well, I half believe it. Just all over right, half, then. Actually. Glass is slightly more than half full.
There you go. See? Told you. You're very good at that, though. Helen, would you like to counter anything Simon said there? Is he a little bit too optimistic?
I mean, I think there are reasons to be optimistic. One other thing I think a lot of people have mentioned is that the sort of job side of things still looks relatively okay. You know, unemployment is still quite low, and you know, a lot of people are still continuing to sort of get pay rises and things like that, which is good for certain parts of the population. But I would agree in that, you know, not everyone is in a cost of living crisis. You know, for a lot of people, like Simon said, it's more of a kind of cost of living inconvenience or a cost of living slight annoyance. But, you know, I would say over the last year or so, more people have kind of dropped into that band where they are really struggling. You know, people who were kind of doing okay before, costs have gone up so much. You know, this is for some people hundreds or £1,000 a year on their energy bills. And I think the number of people who've gone from doing okay or managing to really struggling has really gone up. And I think it takes time to get out of that situation. You know, we've seen things like people going into more debt. You know, debt levels have risen quite a lot on credit cards and things in the last year. And I think the effects of this are going to last for quite some time. You know, it's not necessarily just a case of, oh, inflation's gone down, you know, prices aren't rising as much, these people are okay now. I think the negative that I would counter that with is that, you know, you don't just instantly go from struggling to being okay. You know, the effects of this are probably going to last for quite some time.
So then in that case, Simon Lambert, we think annus tolerabilis and annus mixtum. I don't know. Anyone who speaks Latin, I'm so sorry. I just guess, like, a tolerable year and a mixed year, maybe, is what I said. I don't know.
I'm afraid all of the GCSE Latin I've forgotten didn't extend to that.
Well, you went that far.
Anyway.
Oh,
so,
that far.
Yeah. No. I agree with Helen, actually. Look, I think that there is, you know, despite being asked to take the optimistic side of this debate, I think there is an issue whereby people, you know, there is the whole like, well, if inflation falls back to 2%, great, but stuff is still more expensive. That doesn't mean anything's necessarily got cheaper. I do actually think there are some things that we will find get cheaper. I don't think prices, a lot of the inflation we've seen is essentials inflation. And I think that the prices of some of that stuff is going to come down. Actually, it's not going to stay as elevated as it is now. But, you know, probably not back to the level that it was. And if it does get back to the level that it was, not for some time. You're seeing the reverse of, you know, we're seeing the reverse of the great globalization trend, you know, driven by political factors, geopolitical factors, driven also by people having the desire for a greater sense of, you know, security. And after the whole COVID pandemic and the shutdowns that came with that. So yeah, I think you're not going to see the disinflationary or deflationary elements that you saw through the 2000s, that early 2000s, that just made stuff cheaper and cheaper and cheaper as it was pumped onto our shores. And also you're also seeing the effect of things like net zero pledges coming in. You know, that is making stuff more expensive.
All right, well done, you two. Let's move on. New year, new home. The number of people putting their house up for sale jumped almost 50% on Boxing Day. That's according to Rightmove. The week after Christmas Day, from 26th of December onwards, was also the busiest week for valuation requests since early September, up 29% compared to the same time in 2021. So what is going on? A sign of things to come, or a last hurrah before all goes eerily quiet? Helen, the thing that struck me about this, I mean, there's a few things. The first was, why Boxing Day? Aren't those people just visiting their in-laws and playing board games and nursing a food hangover?
So I've always found this quite fascinating, but it is a documented trend. So estate agents call it the Boxing Day bounce. This actually happens every year. There's a big rush of people either putting their homes up for sale on Boxing Day, or the property portals tend to report a massive rush in traffic of people browsing houses on Boxing Day. I mean, Christmas is just gets quite boring after a while, doesn't it? I think, you know, all good, you spent a few days with your family, but by Boxing Day, probably a bit bored. There isn't actually a lot to do over Christmas, is there? So the theory is that people just think, you know, you start sort of thinking about plans for the year ahead. You've maybe spent a lot of time in your house over Christmas, and it's kind of brought to light the things that you don't like about your house. Maybe you've had family over and there's not really enough room for everyone, and people are thinking, right, okay, this year is going to be the year that I actually make a move. And then when they're sitting in their house on Boxing Day eating their leftover turkey, they're like, why not have a browse on Rightmove or Zoopla? Right. Interesting this year though is, although this is a annual trend, the number of people putting their houses up for sale on Boxing Day this year soared by 46%, and that's compared to last year. So there is a noticeable jump this Boxing Day. I think that might have been impacted a little bit by the fact that, if you remember, around this time in 2021, there was sort of a few concerns about the Omicron variant of COVID, and so maybe that was putting some people off. But this is still a big bump, even compared to Boxing Day last year.
Just on the whole Boxing Day property listing thing, I think Helen's absolutely right to point out the COVID element last year of Omicron. And there was a lot of people who were worried about having their family in their house over Christmas last year. So inviting strangers in was maybe putting some people off. But also the Boxing Day listing phenomenon is becoming a sort of self-fulfilling prophecy, or a phenomenon that's just gaining momentum, because the more it gets talked about, the more it becomes a thing, and the more estate agents go, no, don't put it on now, wait for Boxing Day. Everybody looks at Rightmove on Boxing Day. And so you do genuinely get this kind of like rush of properties. Now, some people try to get in slightly ahead of Boxing Day. They go pre-Christmas. So there's the question of, do you go early? Because, you know, then when people look at their, pick up their phone at 1 minute into Boxing Day, you know, they're still up. They've just finished off their last glass of wine or last glass of port. And like, oh, it's Boxing Day, a little Rightmove. You spot it there, or do you just wait for Boxing Day? But it is a thing. And so people then go on to Rightmove looking at what's been listed on Boxing Day. You also had an absolute dearth of listings in the run-up to Boxing Day this year, where lots of people have held off because of, well, A, the mortgage rate carnage wreaked by the disastrous mini-budget. The dust is only just settling on now. And so a lot of people who were going to list over autumn went, I'm just going to hold off. I'll wait till the new year. I'll see what happens. And then they might have spoken to estate agents who've done the evaluation. They've said, hey, don't wait for new year, Boxing Day. You want to go on Boxing Day. So they've gone on Boxing Day. You had the snow. We had a week of snow that lasted a week, and so on. A lot of different factors came into play here that could contribute to that big, big jump. The one thing I would say to anybody who did list their home for sale on Boxing Day and had the photographs taken in December is, if you had your photographs taken in the snow, it might have made your house look lovely and Christmassy. It also might be time to think about saying to the estate agent, can you come around and take some new photographs? Because there is an issue, and this is a documented thing by estate agents, who say you don't want to have photos that demonstrate your property's been sat there on the market for quite some time. Now, I think we can say Boxing Day to today is not quite some time. We're talking 2 weeks. But if you've still got those photos of the snow in a couple of weeks' time, people are going to be looking at it and they're going to be going, oh, those were taken a while ago. Those were taken in the snow. I remember the snow. That was ages. That was before Christmas. Seems nobody wants to buy this house. You ideally want some photographs taken that don't date the point when the house was listed. And the same here. If you bring your house back to market, right? So say you've put it on the market, you've taken it off the market, and then you put it back on with the same estate agent for whatever reason. Don't let them put it back on with summer photographs, because that instantly demonstrates that your house hasn't sold since summer. The same way around, if you put it on in summer, don't let them put it on with winter photographs and so on. You know, get the estate agents to update the photographs. As for house prices, yes, I would imagine that they are going to fall this year. They're down already. I would say house prices are from their peak down about 10% already, just based on purely anecdotal stuff. Looking at asking prices, places being listed for sale, the fact that people are getting offers accepted below the asking price, whereas before they were having to pay the asking price or maybe a little bit more. I'd say we're already down about 10% from the peak. This kind of stuff doesn't really show through in the main indices, though. But it does show through in what you could sell your house for now compared to what you sort of could have sold your house for in summer. And the big factor that's going to come into play is the fact that people just can't afford to borrow as much money. Mortgage rates are substantially higher than they were in summer and much, much higher than they were a year ago. And that means that the purchasing power of however much you can afford on a mortgage per month, say it's £1,000, say it's £1,500, is tens of thousands of pounds less in borrowed money. And as most people don't have tens of thousands of pounds knocking around with which to suddenly bump up their deposit because they've already put that money into their deposit, that means that they can afford to pay less for houses. The good news is that if you're selling someone a house and you're selling it to them and you're going to have to accept less money off them than you could have got from them in summer, it probably means that the house you're going to buy as well, you can pay less for that and so on and so on and so on. And the only people who really lose out are the people right at the top of the chain who are moving and just cashing in their chips. Often this comes because of death, which is not considered a major win, but all their property investors. And at the top of the chain, they're far more likely to have made lots and lots of money over many, many decades from the property. And so a couple of £10,000 here or there isn't going to make a great difference in the grand scheme of things. Arguably, best thing that could possibly happen in 2023 is that house prices do come down a bit. We don't want to see them crash because it's going to wreak even more economic havoc. But a pause, a coming off the boil, a reset of the relationship with wages would be something that should be welcomed by everybody in this country, because expensive housing, very, very high house prices, is a absolute millstone around our necks. Does a millstone go around your neck? Can't remember. It's a bad thing anyway.
Yeah. So Helen, look, with all of that said, what should you do right now if you are looking to sell or buy? Any tips?
Yeah, well, I think it's definitely a buyer's market. You know, for the last couple of years, it's been very much a seller's market. You know, there's been not enough properties on the market to go around among all the buyers that want to buy. That's definitely changed now, I think. People who are selling their homes are likely to be what we call motivated sellers. So a lot of people have been thinking about selling their homes and maybe holding off to see how all this sort of bad economic news sort of filters down. So people who are deciding to sell probably have a reason to do it. So they're having a kid and they need a bigger house, or they're getting divorced and need to sell the house. You know, these people want to get their houses sold so they can move. What that means is that buyers probably have a bit more room to haggle than they have done in the last couple of years, which is good news, especially for like first-time buyers who obviously don't have a house of their own to sell. If you are a first-time buyer, I would say, I know it's really difficult, but try and make sure you have a bit of wiggle room with the equity in the house you're buying. If we're seeing house prices go down, you know, someone who's put down just a 5% deposit is at a bit of a risk of perhaps negative equity. So if you can at all, try and boost your deposit. And that kind of goes for not just first-time buyers, but people buying with slightly smaller deposits in general. And on the mortgage point, really important, the minute I think that you speak to a broker, there's still a lot of change in the mortgage market. Rates are high. Brokers will be able to give you best advice for what works for your situation and might be able to find better rates as well. You know, they quite often have access to exclusive deals and just kind of talk you through what the situation is and what the best deal is for you. You can also check mortgage rates if you go to This Is Money website. We have a tool as a partnership with the broker LNC. It will show you all the latest rates, and you can also go to them and get fee-free advice.
Helen, thank you very much. As I mentioned earlier, we could have just changed the intro to the last one to this next story, because one reason you may need to sell soon is sadly you've decided to call it quits with your other half. January the 9th is Divorce Day, the first working Monday of every new year when divorce lawyers are inundated with inquiries from unhappily married couples sitting there eating turkey over the festive period thinking, why on earth am I still here? Presumably, I don't know. This year, though, is a little different, maybe. The first since new no-fault laws came in last spring, meant to speed up and simplify the process. So more divorces you might expect, because it's quicker and easier and less hassle and less stress and shouting at each other, blaming them for each other for stuff. But is there something holding unhappy couples together? The cost of living crisis. Simon briefly knew no-fault laws that came in, and money holding couples together, hasn't it always been thus?
I thought you were going to start off by asking me about why is Monday Divorce Day? And I was going to say, because you can't do it on Boxing Day, maybe.
Well, yeah, because everybody's too busy looking at Rightmove, though. And then once they're bored with Rightmove, a few days later, they start then looking at law firms.
Yeah, yeah. So under the old law, divorces were only granted if there was an irretrievable breakdown of a marriage. Either one spouse had to allege fault by the other, like adultery, unreasonable behaviour or desertion, or provided both parties agreed, the couple had to separate for at least 2 years to show sufficient evidence the split was serious. A five-year separation was needed to divorce with no consent by one partner. Couples can now get a no-fault divorce within 6 months. Joint applications are allowed, or one spouse can file, and then they have 28 days to notify their partner by email by default, plus via printed a confirmation of the email by post. I'm reading that bit, by the way, just in case you didn't notice. Then a conditional order for divorce, previously the decree nisi, can be applied for 20 weeks after the first filing, and a final order, previously the decree absolute, can be applied for after 26 weeks. And divorces will proceed even if one partner is against it, provided the right procedures have been followed. The divorce laws did always seem a bit archaic to me. I mean, I'm very, very pro people trying to work things out and stick together, stand by their marriage vows and all that kind of stuff. But those divorce laws were very, very archaic. I don't actually think, though, in many cases, it's the divorce laws that causes people most of the problems. It's the trying to sort stuff out when they do split.
Money. How much does that play?
A huge part. I think that is the point where people always, well, not always, but very often end up in arguments and end up in a position where they might get what they feel is a raw deal, or at some point in the future think they've got a raw deal. And it's a very awkward situation because, you know, if you've been married for some time, trying to untangle your finances is pretty complicated. You know, you might have one partner who's the higher earner. You might have one partner who paid more into the mortgage, who put more into the house, but the other partner might have been, you know, looking after the children, in which case, obviously, the law allows for that. Or it might just be that one partner was always the higher, that there's no children involved. One partner was always the higher earner. One partner was the lower earner. But they were perfectly happy with that when they were a happy couple. And I pay more because I've got more money, and so on. And then all of a sudden it falls apart and you end up with arguments and someone saying, well, I want half the house. And someone says, well, you didn't put half the money into the house. And I mean, I've seen this happen actually with people who haven't even been married for very long. And it's ended up in it with the who don't have particularly tangled finances. So you do really, really, really need to understand what's going on and get some good advice, I think.
Helen, anything to add on this one? Divorce Day?
Yeah, I mean, just I think, you know, people might think that it seems a bit extreme, you know, putting off a divorce because of money. But I can actually completely see why this would happen. You know, for a lot of people, getting divorced, even if you are the higher earner, it's a huge downgrade. It can be in terms of your sort of living situation, you know, smaller house, different car. It's your living situation is going to be probably hugely different, you know, having two salaries, especially when it makes a massive difference to your life and what you can do. And having kind of lived in a couple before and lived on my own before, you know, the cost of everything when you're living on your own basically doubles. You know, there's discounts on some things, you know, council tax, you get a little bit of a discount, but it's not a 50% discount. So it's a huge hit to your finances. And I think while people might think, God, that's mad, staying in a unhappy marriage just to have a bit more money, it is a big life change. And I think it's not to be kind of underestimated, I think.
Indeed. Sorry if you're going through that at the moment. That's it for part one.
I'm joined now by Sam North of eToro for our weekly look at what's been happening on the markets. Sam, the start of a new trading year. So how's it been?
Yeah, just like that, we're in 2023. It's just incredible. I think the first thing to note is that the period between Christmas and New Year's was really quiet. Markets didn't do too much for the most part. They stayed within their key ranges. And obviously this Monday was a bank holiday, so it wasn't really until Tuesday that things started to spice up a little bit, but again, still within those key ranges. One noticeable thing this week, however, is that the market is not responding well to good news. So going into the US jobs report later, we're actually primed for quite a strong report based on a few data metrics we've already had this week, which have been good and therefore sent the market lower. So it's almost like a good report today is sending a message to the Federal Reserve that they don't need to support the market as much or as soon as people might be thinking. So for now, good news is bad news, and bad news, which might be a bad jobs report, for example, would be good news. Confusing, right?
Do we think that's going to continue for the rest of 2023, or are we going to see that effect start to ebb away?
Well, yeah, I think it's going to be, next week's is interesting because you've got inflation. So if inflation was to come out, you know, a little bit better than expected, the market is going to love it. So that's next Thursday. And really for the rest of, I'd say, the month, we're really going to be, and probably a couple of months, we're going to be keeping an eye on a few things. Inflation, and therefore the effect that has on interest rates, growth in, you know, all parts of the world, but also how earnings have been doing. So earnings kick off again next week. So on Friday, you've got the US banks. So that's really the sort of the unofficial start of earnings season. So quarter four earnings from last year. So it'd be really interesting to see the effect that, you know, the last year or so has had on markets. So yeah, next week, US inflation on Thursday, the main event. And then on Friday, we've got all those US earnings as well. And I think this time next week, we're going to know a lot more about how the markets are going to behave in the next few weeks and months.
Okay, Sam, well, thank you very much for that. And I should have started by saying Happy New Year to you. Happy New Year
to you. And to you too.
Welcome back. We've covered the cost of living, housing and marriage. But what about pensions in 2023? The state pension is going up by a record amount in April, thanks to the triple lock commitment. So can pensioners put their feet up, whack up the heating with abandon? So flush with cash are they. Also, with the government strapped for money and grabbing more from workers, savers, investors, is now a good time to make use of the tax perks available when you put money aside for retirement? So, Helen, what is changing in 2023 for pensioners?
Well, on the face of it, not a lot. So obviously at the last year, the big issue was the pensions triple lock and whether that was going to be saved. It was saved in the end. So they're getting a 10.1% rise in their pension from April. Seems like very good news. I think the issue is that there's a lot of things that are still on the table when it comes to pensions in 2023. You know, pensions are a safe haven for now, but it definitely seems like they're not going to be for long. You know, issues still on the table, taxes, triple lock is probably going to come up again at some point. You know, it's a huge cost to the government, and with inflation still going quite a lot, I don't know. I think that can't kind of last forever. The government's also probably going to make a decision soon on when they're going to raise the state pension age to 68. So while pensioners are kind of okay for now, there's definitely still a lot of things on the horizon that they perhaps need to be aware of. You did mention though, there's all perks for pensioners this year. Basically, saving into pension is a very good way to reduce the tax you pay. So you save into a pension out of untaxed income. You receive rebates, effectively free cash from the government paid into your pension based on your income tax rate. And at a time when tax thresholds are going up in a lot of different areas, it's a good year to, if you're able to, and I recognise a lot of people probably won't be able to because of the cost of living crisis, if you're able to put more money into your pension this year, it's a very good time to do it.
And this is something that is especially true if you're one of those people near one of the weird parts of the tax code that create cliff edges and very, very high rates of tax. So, for example, people with children get their child benefit taken off them if one partner earns above £50,000 and it gets taken away between £50,000 and £60,000. That can create a marginal tax rate of well above 50%. Much higher earners, those on more than £100,000, get their personal allowance removed, which creates an effective tax rate of 60%. For them, it definitely makes sense to try to pay some money into a pension because it reduces their taxable income and can pull them back down below the threshold. And then also, obviously, the higher rate tax threshold is coming down, and so on and so on. But as Helen said, it does depend on people actually having the money to do this. And there will be many people who sit there and do a tax return, which lots of people will be doing this month because it has to be done by the end of January. And their calculation shows that they have to hand over some money in tax. And they'll think, right, next year, I'm going to try and make it that I don't have to do that. So before the April 6th, the end of this tax year, I need to pay some extra money into a pension so that next year I don't get hit with this extra amount. And then they're going to look at their bank balances and go, now, where is that extra money I'm going to pay into that pension? Oh, I don't appear to have it. So it's all very well saying this, I think, but often the ability to do it for many people is quite difficult. But there is a real benefit from saving into a pension. And you should definitely, I would say, if you are an employee, you will probably have been auto-enrolled, but make sure you are paying as much into your work pension as you can to get the maximum benefit from your employer. So say, for example, your employer says they will match your contributions up to 6%, pay in 6%. Don't just pay in 4%, because otherwise you're leaving money on the table. And you'll also get the benefit of basic rate tax relief as well, which is a big boost. And if you're a higher rate taxpayer, you can claim back more through your tax return.
Helen, you have an article on your website, 1 million older workers face new pension misery. Bond rout wipes a third off funds just as retirement looms. Tell me more about this article. What is lifestyling? What is this all about?
Sure. So this is another story that harks back to that disastrous mini budget, which I feel like we keep coming back to, but it did really sort of rock the market. So this is talking about people whose pensions are partially invested in government bonds. So we're traditionally seen as quite a safe investment, but when Kwasi Kwarteng made all these unfunded tax announcements in the mini budget, that really rocked the market's kind of confidence in government bonds, and there was a massive sell-off. It's sort of sorted itself out a little bit, but they were still one of the worst performing assets last year. What that means is people who have part of their pensions invested in bonds, their funds have gone down in value potentially by quite a bit. The people who are worst affected by this is these million workers that you mentioned. They're people who took out workplace pensions in the 90s and 2000s, or who paid into individual stakeholder plans over the past two decades. That would be some of the big household names, or Legal & General, Fidelity, Aon, and the like. And the reason that they're affected is because their pension pots, typically when they're getting close to retirement age, normally 5 years before, they're moved into funds called lifestyling funds. These are fixed income investments, and they're supposed to be less risky than other more volatile investments, which is why they're moved there. The intention is to kind of make sure their income is safe as they're directly in the kind of run-up to retirement. Bonds are normally quite a big part of what pensions are lifestyled into in that period, because they're supposed to be quite safe, but obviously they haven't been in the last few months, which has meant that these people have now actually seen their funds drop in value potentially by quite a large amount, thanks again to Kwasi Kwarteng's disastrous mini budget.
Yeah, let's hope 2023 doesn't involve many more mentions of that. Finally, ending on a bit of good news. This month's premium bonds prize draw saw NS&I increase the prize fund rate from 2.2% to 3%, with an extra 80 million quid thrown in the prize pot compared to December. So the changes mean that the prize fund rate has now tripled from 1% to 3% since May. And this month's jackpot winner also bagged a million, with just £4,625 holding. So, Simon Lambert, do we plow all of our money into premium bonds? How does it work? Is it worth it?
What a result, hey? What a result. There were two millionaires, okay? One of them was from Wiltshire, and they won with the maximum holding of £50,000. The other one was from South Yorkshire, and they won with only £4,625 in bonds, putting them in the top 10% of the smallest holdings to scoop the £1 million prize ever. See? People from Yorkshire's reputation for being thrifty is absolutely deserved. These southern softies, they have to stick 50 grand in to win a million. Come from Yorkshire, do it for less than 5 grand. They don't say 5 grand in Yorkshire. Do they say 5 grand in Yorkshire? I don't know. I used to live in Leeds, I should know. Actually, premium bonds look pretty good at the moment. The effective prize rate of 3% is the highest since November 2008. But more to the point, it actually compares very, very favourably with the top easy access savings accounts. 3% on the premium bonds looks pretty tasty by comparison, and so is potentially well worth taking. It's not technically an easy access savings account because you can't get your money out instantly, but you can get your money out a hell of a lot quicker than you used to be able to. And unless you need the money like that, so say for example you've got some money that you can get like that, and then you can go, okay, well I can wait a little bit of time for the money in the premium bonds, then yeah, I'd say good place to put your money at the moment. Of course, the problem is that you might not get that effective 3% savings rate. You might be really unlucky and you might get nothing, or you might be like the person from Yorkshire,
lucky. So Helen, premium bonds winner?
Potentially. I mean, it's a bit of fun, isn't it? Having a kind of lottery every month to see if you win £1 million. I mean, a lot more fun if you do actually win the £1 million. I don't know. For me, I kind of like getting my set interest every month, the kind of knowing how much I'm going to get on my savings. But maybe I'm just a boring person.
Oh, I wouldn't go that far. Just be so mean to yourself. Who actually here has premium bonds, by the way? Yeah. There's one show of hand there, Simon. You had, yeah. Or you have?
No, I have. I have premium bonds. And actually, I use it as, it's kind of my rainy day cash fund money is what it is. It's the, marvelous. You know, the money that you've got set aside in case disaster strikes. And I always think that the premium bonds isn't a bad place to have that. I mean, it's a better place to have it now than it was relatively recently when the rate was lower. Now that it's much more competitive compared to a savings account. But I think, yeah, it's a decent place to have it because if something happened and I needed money instantly, I could get some money instantly from my current account. And then if I needed to dip into my savings, I reckon I could probably buy myself enough time to get the money out of the premium bonds.
Marvellous, marvellous.
You never know. I might win £1 million one day.
You never know, Simon. You never know. Another optimistic end to our podcast and the first for the new year. Happy New Year, everyone. You can keep up to date with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app. And if you have any comments or questions for the team or anything you'd like them to look into, Simon?
You can email us at editor@thisismoney.co.uk. You can tweet us at thisismoney, or you can come to thisismoney.co.uk/podcast to find all podcasts past, join in the debate and read the comments.
And if you like our podcast, why not rate us wherever you found us? It helps other people find us too.
Market updates and conversations around the financial world don't have to be boring. The Digest and Invest podcast by eToro is a great way to tune into what's happening in a fun and easily digestible format. Discover the Digest and Invest podcast at eToro.com/academy/podcasts.